Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, at and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site are links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. My most recent column for the West is The Guardian, and Who Owns Your Data, is or soon will be available on the website, www.westchesterguardian.com. It is the 134th column in the Creative Disruption series. In relation to this show, I've set up the GoFundMe site to try to ensure its ongoing sustainability, but as yet the response has been underwhelming. But I haven't publicized it very well. I will have to. The link is also available on my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com. Callers may call in at any time during this show by dialing 646-716-9657. That's 646-716-9657. I do hold the on-air participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest next week on this show, science fiction writer Walter John Williams, who is currently in France and hurrying home to be on the show. Tune in and listen. My guest tonight is the multifaceted Kurt Anderson, named by New York Magazine as one of the 100 people who changed New York, and by Forbes Magazine as one of the 25 most influential liberals in the U.S. media. Kurt has been the magazine founder, then editor, then essayist, then novelist, then radio show host, and successful in all of the above. We'll explore all of the aspects of his fascinating life tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Kurt, and welcome to the show.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. And I realize now that just earlier tonight, just a couple of hours ago, I was speeding past Lake Osceola on the Taconic State Parkway. So I could have stopped by.
So let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and went to public schools there until I graduated high school.
Does the EN spelling of Anderson denote Scandinavian family origins?
It specifically denotes Danish family origins as opposed to Swedish. It can also be Norwegian, but in my case, it's Danish.
Okay. Were you the writer in high school?
Was I what in high school?
The writer.
I was. I was a writer. Starting really in junior high, I got my main activity was writing for and editing the school newspaper. So yeah, I was already on the road to doing what I'm doing now. Then
after high school, you came east to what we think of as from the conservative Midwest to the bastion of Eastern liberalism, Harvard University. Was there culture shock?
There was culture shock, not so much in the conservative liberal sense, but I, you know, from like 10 or 11, I sort of had my internal gyroscope turned east or northeast. I kind of knew that I wanted to be in a big city. I got this sense as a child that the east was where I wanted to be. It was a culture shock. I mean, I knew what I was getting into because I'd, you know, seen movies and television and read books. But Omaha, Nebraska in 1972 was a very different place than Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the grandeur of the reputation, the East Coast city, the you know, 200, 300-year-old buildings, all of it was shocking in a great way. I mean, it was a culture shock, but of a kind of expected and, to me, delightful kind.
What did you major in at Harvard, and how much writing did you do there?
I majored in a kind of a combination of sociology, economics, and history. Sociology was my degree, and that was what I studied. But then freshman year, first thing, 3 months after I arrived, I joined the Harvard Lampoon. So that became really not only the focus of my extracurricular life, but the focus of my life in general while I was in college.
In 1980, you published the book of essays, The Real Thing, and a humor book, Tools of Power. Tell us about those works.
The Real Thing was a book that actually, my first job at that time out of college was writing for Gene Shalit, who was then on the Today Show every day as their movie critic and their cultural commentator. He also had a daily radio program on what was then the NBC radio network, and he hired me to research for his television stuff and to write the daily essay he did on radio, which I did. He had this idea for a book called The Real Thing that I, as his employee, was going to write for him. And then a few months into that, when I'd written some of it, he said, you know, you should just write this. It should have your name on it. This shouldn't be a ghostwriting thing. Just do it. And got the publisher to agree. And so that's how that came about. And at 26, I suddenly was a published author, which was great. Tools of Power was the idea of a young editor named Ruth Liebman at Viking Press, who had this idea and recruited me and a couple of my friends, writer friends, to write a parody. What it was a parody of what had become a kind of a genre and publishing phenomenon right then, which is the sort of the business self-help book, How to Be Successful. And so that's what it was a parody of that. And The Real Thing, to my great happiness and pleasure, was recently republished by the University of Nebraska Press. So the old home state press somehow decided that would be a good idea, and so that has had a second life recently.
I know that in addition to these works, you did some writing for both New York and The New Yorker, and you were the architecture and design critic for Time magazine. What was the design background that got you into that?
Precious little. In addition to economics, history, and sociology courses that I took, there weren't minors at Harvard then, but if I'd had a minor, it would have been in sort of fine arts, architectural history. So I had taken some courses at college, but if I was a frustrated anything, it was a frustrated architect, but I could never draw, so I didn't pursue that. So I was already at Time magazine and doing okay and working there, they decided they wanted to start have a critic and reporter covering architecture and design, and they hired an entirely well-credentialed, suitably experienced person for that, and that didn't work out. And they got rid of him after a year, and I volunteered and said, I know something about this. I can do this. And they decided to take a risk and take a chance and gave me the job, which I then did for some years.
To show how technology changes, in today's world, you wouldn't have to draw to be an architect.
Oh, exactly. And in fact, a friend of mine who's a classical architect just wrote a piece saying he said there were only two schools, one school remaining, Notre Dame, and another one about to start in New Jersey, Art Schools of Architecture, that require hand drawing in the first few years. So, yes, indeed. And maybe even then. So who knew? I could have – there were no computers to do the drawing in 1975, but absolutely right. And the fact that I could have become an architect, having not knowing how to draw, is probably a good argument for why architects should have to draw, because I probably wouldn't have been a very good one.
Yeah, I have a friend who went to Catholic U, who's an architect, but he's had to immerse himself in the new technology as it went along, because he, like you, would have been before there was Autodesk, which is the is doing everything now. Then you founded Spy Magazine with Graydon Carter in 1986. Had you done anything else to prepare you for an entrepreneurial move like that?
Well, you know, I mean, again, not so much. I had been at that point in New York for almost a decade. I had done journalism. I had been involved in sort of one-shot parody publications of various kinds. I had this in mind, and I had started, you know, reading the trade magazines of the magazine profession, and Graydon, my co-founder, had actually run a little magazine in Canada for a few years, so he had that. He had actual experience. No, not much. For instance, I had never been an editor of anything, and decided, no, I can do this. I have a vision for this magazine. I can edit things. I edit my own work. My entire work history is a series of jobs and projects, for which I have, precious little, bona fide experience.
Learned on the job. Tell us about Spy. That was a well-known publication for a good while.
Yeah, Spy was great. Spy was a delight. It was. The idea was that Graydon and I started talking. Graydon also worked at Time, and we became friends. And we just started talking as we became friends over lunches and stuff about the magazines we had loved as kids, as young people, and why wasn't there a magazine like Esquire of the 60s around? Why wasn't there a magazine that we loved so much like National Lampoon? All these magazines, Mad Magazine, New York Magazine in its early days, that we'd grown up with and started as a lark describing a magazine that we would start. If we were going to start a magazine, it would do this. It would be funny. It would be satirical. But it wouldn't be just humor. It would be reported and researched. And at a certain point, we decided, well, maybe we should try to do this. And we teamed up with a third partner who was the business guy, and raised the money in 1986 and got it going. And it was for a lot of reasons. We were lucky. I mean, we were lucky that we found each other and the people we hired to put out the magazine with us. We were lucky that we went out to raise money after there had been a great bull market on Wall Street for a few years, and we found some people who suddenly had who were in the spirit of doing this slightly crazy project, but had extra money that they could throw into this as an investment. We were lucky that there was no internet. I honestly think we were able to do this, to create this magazine of that really had nothing else like it in the United States at that time. And I think we did it well, and by doing it well, we got a tremendous amount of impact very quickly because we were kind of the only game in town. Whereas as soon as there was a web, there were every idea has 100 or more competitors. And so the fact that it was late in the day of the pre-digital magazine age, I think, was as it turned out, a great lucky benefit.
You mentioned New York Magazine. I'm old enough to remember when it was the Sunday insert, the Sunday magazine for New York Herald Tribune, and
wow.
Jimmy Breslin, then Pete Hamill and Tom Wolfe and Dick Sharp,
sure,
and people like that were part of that. Until it was spun off after the Herald Tribune merged with the Journal American and the World Telegram.
Right.
Speaking of New York Magazine, after selling Spy, you did a number of things, including editing New York Magazine, the job that ended under controversial circumstances. Tell us about your years there and the ending.
Well, I was hired. We sold Spy. We left Spy. I went back to Time Magazine for a year as a kind of editor at large and had great fun there. And then the people who then owned New York Magazine decided they wanted to totally reinvigorate, relaunch it. The word they used was, we wanted to have edge. We wanted to have edge. I said, okay, I think I know what that means. And I wrote a memo saying, here's what I would do with the magazine. They said, great, you're on. You're be the editor of this weekly magazine. And And I was, and I did, and circulation went up, and ad sales went up, and by all measures, things were going great. They seemed that they never, my boss never, ever said anything but, great job, going great. Their main investor, backer, owner, de facto owner, is a guy named Henry Kravis, who's a huge private equity zillionaire. Called me after I'd done the job for a little over a couple of years, called me in for breakfast, and we had recently done a cover story about some Wall Street players who were friends and associates of his, and he was not pleased by the piece and proposed that New York Magazine should never cover the financial world or Wall Street again. And I, you know, politely said, we're going to have to agree to disagree because New York, I mean, the financial world is a large part of what New York City is and New York Magazine must cover. And went back to my bosses and said, I had this odd breakfast with Henry. And they said, don't pay no attention. Go ahead, do what you're doing. You're doing a great job. I said, great. And then 6 months later, with no word, I was suddenly handed my walking papers, and after a little less than 3 years, that was that.
And you mentioned, to me, that you were told that it was because circulation going down and to cut expenses rather than what you assumed was the reason. Is that true?
Well, the idea that circulation had not gone down. It had not gone, the overall circulation had not gone up much. The bosses who fired me said, why did you fire him? They said, oh, the circulation hadn't gone up enough. That had never ever been mentioned to me as a thing we needed to do significantly, or that it was a problem that it hadn't happened. So there's that. My best guess, only God can know what is in their hearts and minds and what happened behind closed doors. My absolute conviction is that they needed to have, for this magazine that suddenly was having more attention paid for to it, that the newsstand sales had gone up, that the advertising sales had gone up way up, that they needed to have a reason and a semi-plausible reason. Well, you know, the overall circulation has not gone up in the last 2 years. Let's give that as a reason. So that's why I believe they gave that reason.
How long was that before Clay Felker took it over?
Clay Felker, actually, I was post Clay Felker. Clay Felker was almost more than a decade before me, actually.
Oh, okay. Didn't he come back at the end? Didn't he do something?
He did not. He did not. He did not come back to New York. No.
Then 1999, you both wrote and published your first novel, Turn of the Century, and then founded the online media news site and biweekly magazine Insight. That was one busy year for you. Tell us about both of those.
It was a very busy year. I was fired from New York and immediately started writing for Tina Brown's New Yorker, which was great fun. I wrote a weekly column and other pieces for the New Yorker. Then, but at the same time, I decided that instead of keeping on saying as I had for 15 years or more, oh, I should write a novel. I really want to write a novel. I should write a novel. I decided it was sort of now or never. I no longer had a 9-to-5 or more like 8-to-8 day job, and it was time to do it. So I decided to write a novel. The novel came out turn of the century in 1999, and at the same time, and I decided to move on from the New Yorker and start. It was what was then called the dot-com bubble or the dot-com boom, not yet a bubble, but it was the first. The first 4 or 5 years of the web computer revolution had happened, and it seemed, ironically today, 15 years later, sort of late in the game. And I wanted to get in on this, and so my friend Michael Hirshhorn, who'd worked for me and been my number two at New York Magazine, and I decided, oh, we should start a online new daily newspaper, essentially, that is all about the entertainment and media industries and especially their evolution that is obviously going to be happening in this new digital age. And we raised money and hired a bunch of amazing people many of whom have gone on to great glory at places like the New York Times and elsewhere. And for a couple of years operated Inside.com and then sold it to Primedia, which ironically was the company that owned New York Magazine who had fired me 5 years earlier.
In the 1990s, you're also involved in some television work. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I have been involved in television work, off and on in small bits and pieces, really for the last 20 years. At Spy, once Spy got going, we went to NBC saying, oh, we should do a weekly kind of funny news discussion show could be on Sunday mornings as a sort of counter programming to the Meet the Presses and Face the Nations of the World. And we were talking to the head of NBC Entertainment, Brandon Tartikoff, who said, well, I don't control Sunday, but how about we do some specials? So we did some specials on primetime and NBC, and they did okay. I got my first taste of it, and we did a pilot for NBC. I did a pilot, again, a nonfiction pilot for ABC as well. So I got the taste, and I enjoyed that. I didn't enjoy it enough that I wanted to ever, so far, throw my entire self into that world. I felt and still feel as though book writing and novel writing and storytelling of a print kind is where at least I can have much more control. And when I write a book, I can be fairly certain that it's going to see the light of day and get published, unlike television or movies or the rest of show business, where so much of it is out of one's own control. But yeah, I enjoyed learning about getting sort of cutting my chops on TV and have been involved off and on with other TV projects ever since. After the turn of the century in the early 2000s, I went to work at the USA cable channels, which Barry Diller then ran, sort of working on projects there, and so I've had, if not a hand in television consistently, and a little bit in movies, a couple of fingers for most of the last 20 years.
My son Luke is a TV writer. He decided in grammar school this was what he wanted to do, and he's been able to make a living at it. He asked me this summer before he decided to move to Hollywood if I knew anyone that owned a bar. And growing up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood, of course I did. So he said, can you get me a job bartending and I can learn how to bartend in case I ever have to fall back on it? So I did, and he worked all summer as a weekend bartender. Then he went off to Hollywood, and thankfully he's never had to use it. So
that's fantastic. Yeah. That's fantastic.
In 2000, you began this still-running Peabody Award-winning Studio 360 on public radio. Studio 360 is a weekly public radio program about arts and culture hosted by you. Tell us about how that came to happen.
That came to happen, again, it's a great example of you never know where things are going to come from or how they're going to come. That was a call out of the blue by the people at Public Radio International, who are the producers and co-producers, really, with WNYC, the New York Public Radio Station, saying, would you be interested in doing this? And I literally wasn't sure. They might not have had the wrong person. I said, I have been on the radio. I've been interviewed on the radio, but I have no experience as a radio host or anything. They said, no, we just think you'd be good. I said, okay. And I said, what's the show? And the show was the extent of the conception of the show was about what you said then, which is to say a weekly show about arts and culture. So we hadn't, it was there to invent, and And once they decided, no, you're our guy, and they were willing to take that risk, which is extraordinary, I decided, well, I'm willing to take this risk too, and we'll invent it together. And so we did, and we have, and it's been an extraordinary opportunity that I still love doing, and it's still interesting to me. Because it's once a week, people often say, oh, wouldn't you like to do it every day, or wouldn't you like to do it something on TV or whatever? And my answer is always no, because it is for me in my life, which is to say, I still write novels, I still write books, I still have these occasional TV projects. It allows me to do those other things that I want to do without, you know, if it were a daily program, that would be a life-consuming operation. So it's fantastic, and I get to talk to people who have fascinated me, whom I've admired, who are heroes. It's a great gig, and we have, I don't know, 600,000 listeners over the air every week, and another few hundred thousand by podcasts. It's worked out, and it is by far, in terms of any job or job-like thing I've ever had, it's by far the longest-lasting one I've ever had.
Yeah, and as you say, you know, a weekly show, it takes me 5 to 10 times longer than the broadcasting time to research the people and put
them
together. And between writing a column and teaching college, I'm lucky I can get all this done.
Yeah.
So I'll come back to Studio 360 in a bit. I have a lot to ask about that. But first, I want to get into some other things that you've done since the beginning of the radio show. I'm amazed you've been able to do so much. After selling Inside in 2001, you were, as you mentioned, a creative consultant to Universal Television, and then editorial director of Colors Magazine. What was that?
Colors Magazine was a magazine that was founded in the mid-90s by Benetton, the fashion company, the Italian fashion company, which was just exploding then, and had this sort of brand idea of internationalism and multiculturalism. And they hired a guy whom I didn't yet know but had heard of, a brilliant guy who was by trade a graphic designer but was really much more than a graphic designer. He was a great creator, auteur, genius named Tibor Kalman, to start this magazine. And Tibor started it. Then came to me and said, do you want to quit whatever you're doing? I guess I was doing New York Magazine then. He said, do you want to quit that and come to Rome and create this magazine with me? I said, sounds fantastic, but no, I have a commitment to this other job. Tibor and I became friends as he was doing Colors. I loved it. It was really a provocative, fantastic magazine that had shared some DNA with Spy magazine as well. I mean, it was a different thing, but it was mischievous and strange in some ways that were similar. And then Tibor stopped doing that, and Tibor, unfortunately, at a very, very young age, at 49, got cancer and died. Just a few years, like in 2002, 2003, the Benetton people came to me and said, hey, do you want to, take this over as a quarterly? And I said, sure, that sounds great. But I said at the time, as it was beginning, this is not, I would just like to do it for a year and a half and do, four or six issues, and then you can get somebody else to do it. And they said, great. And so that's what we did. It was fun, and it was fun to sort of be back in the magazine game in a kind of particular, relatively low pressure way, because it wasn't a weekly anymore. It wasn't a monthly that I owned. It was a quarterly, and so it was a different way to skin the magazine cat, and it was huge fun and put out those issues. Yeah, and it was that was. Other than writing for magazines, which I still occasionally do, it was the last time I edited one, and it was both a reminder of what I loved about doing that, and also made me realize, I'm pretty much done with that as a phase of my life.
You really ramped it up after 2005, publishing two novels, the nonfiction book, writing op-ed pieces, the newspaper looked like the Times, starting an email service, beginning another radio show, publishing the Spy anthology, and serving as editor-at-large for Random House. Now, let's take that one by one. In 2006, you co-founded a very short list, the email, the list that I mentioned. What's its purpose, and how does it work?
Its purpose was and is to a friend whom I'd met through my work with Barry Diller, named Michael Jackson, not the late Michael Jackson, but a still living British Michael Jackson. We became friends during that project, the projects with Barry Diller, and decided afterwards, you know, we were having again lunches and started talking about the glut of stuff that. To which the web opened up our world of all this, you know, and this was again just as right before YouTube had even started, but just through the availability of books and videos and films and music and all this stuff, we felt like not only kids in a candy store, but kids in a candy store who didn't even know where half the candy was and were overwhelmed by all of it, and thought, wouldn't it be good if there were a thing that could sort of curate this for you. Our initial idea was to people would subscribe and we would send them a box, a beautifully designed box full of stuff, a great CD they wouldn't know about otherwise, a great book, a great DVD, a great artifact, any and all stuff that we would find and curate in the world and they would subscribe to. We went to Mr. Diller to fund this. He thought it was a fantastic idea. Some of his more prudent lieutenants decided, nah, maybe not. And then we got to talking about, oh, well, we could do this electronically. Instead of sending you the physical stuff, we will send you a newsletter once a day saying, here is an extraordinary thing that you probably don't know about because it hasn't come out yet or it's obscure or whatever. And here it is, and here's a wonderful piece of writing telling you why it's good, and a link to it if it's online. So that's what it was. It was a kind of, you know, early Web 2.0 attempt at curating the kind of the cultural overflow that was happening, and saying here's a daily guide to something great. If you're a person who wants to try to keep up with the little jewels that are emerging all the time, but you feel overwhelmed by how to find them, here they are. So that's what that was, and that it's still going. It was subsequently sold to the New York Observer company, the Observer Media, who still put it out, and so that's what that was.
Then in 2007, you came out with your second novel, Heyday. Tell us about that book.
That book I'd had a germ of an idea of that book long before I'd ever published novels. I became fascinated at some point many years ago with the year 1848. As Americans, we are all familiar with 1848 as the year of the California Gold Rush. When and this may have even been in college, but or maybe shortly after, but I learned about the all the revolutions that swept Europe in 1848, and I suddenly got to thinking, well, maybe there's characters in a story that would tie these two extraordinary simultaneous things together, one of which Americans know something about, the Gold Rush, the other of which, the revolutions in Europe, Americans know almost nothing about. And then I just started reading and researching really intense. I mean, I've said that the year and a half I spent researching that novel, I practically have a self-administered master's degree in 1848, because I really came to realize that not only do Americans not know very much about Europe in 1848 and the revolutions, but in general, that period, except for the Western migration in America and the Gold Rush, it's a period that, at least in the history I learned in school, breezed over it pretty quickly. I mean, you go from the Revolutionary War, Jackson, sort of, and then there's the Civil War. You know, but I found once I started learning for the first time about all the extraordinary things of that period, and the beginning of the telegraph, and the beginning of the railroads, and the beginning of advertising, and the existence of all of these utopian communes all over what was then the West, in the Midwest. All these things, I really had, and suddenly newspapers were not just these small circulation things, but these massive circulation things, and presses were getting faster and faster. I suddenly saw that it was beyond my initial idea of gold rush and revolutions, that it was just a moment when that I didn't know about. And I think people, if I didn't know about this and I find it so interesting, so will readers. And it really seemed to me also a time, if you were going to pick a time when modern life, modern American, modern Western life really began, it was right then. And so I just became more and more excited and came up with a story of about four young people sort of colliding and finding each other and heading on a Western journey from New York to San Francisco.
There's been so much even after that that we know little about, like the linking of the Transcontinental Railroad and the competition between the what we'd now call venture capitalists out in California to fighting back and forth. Who's going to make the link and how are they going to do it? That's just fascinating when you get into that.
You know, it really is. Well, and Abraham Lincoln was a congressman then, just beginning his political career, and of course it was he who really made the Transcontinental Railroad happen 20 years after that. And also this idea of the gold. Once I started reading about the gold rush and the creation of San Francisco from scratch, as I was writing this in the early 2000s, the parallels with the gold rush, the digital gold rush, the web gold rush of the late 90s and going on to today were just, unmistakable. I mean, suddenly thousands of people who want to get rich and live free and try something new were rushing to Northern California in 1848 and 1849, as they were again over the last 20 years.
The 49ers. In 2009, you came out with a nonfiction book that was a departure for you from what you had just done, Reset. What was that about, and why did you get into that?
Well, at that time, even after I left Time magazine, I sort of knew a lot of people there and retained friendships there and occasionally wrote pieces for them. And the editor then of Time magazine was my friend Rick Stengel, who is now the Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy. But he was editor of Time, and as the financial crisis happened and the meltdown happened and the Great Recession began at the beginning of 2009, he said, "I would really love to have you write an essay explaining this in your own special way." And I said, "Well, I it's nothing I'd thought of doing, but let me think about it." And I thought about it for a day and thought, "No, I really want to do this." So it began life as a cover story for Time magazine that came out in the March of 2009, basically arguing that this is terrifying. And here's how we got here. Here's how we got here over the last essentially 20 years of easier and easier money and more heedless, financial speculation of various kinds and living high on the hog in all kinds of ways. And yes, it's terrifying. We don't know how this is going to end yet, but it's also, if we play our cards right and see it as an opportunity and step away and manage to get away from the edge of the abyss, it can actually be an opportunity to operate our politics and our economy and our culture more sanely. And here's the opportunity that I think this gives us. And then Random House when that came out, said, "Why don't you put the, turn this into a little book?" And I said, "I think that's a great idea," and did, and that was Reset.
Then in 2012, you published your most recent novel, True Believers, that I, by the way, thought was terrific. I told you that on Facebook as soon as I read it. Tell us about that work. How did that germinate?
That germinated, again, I don't remember when or how, but I had, you know, the basics of an idea about some people, some young, very young people, 18, 19-year-olds in 1968, 69, people who were 5 or 6 years older than I in real life, but who at the height of the Vietnam War became extreme in their belief that something had to be done to stop the war, and through whom one could see in a way that I hadn't seen done about the kinds of characters I hadn't seen before, about how the what we know as the 60s became the 60s and the run up in a child's mind, because my narrator is a girl and then a woman who is in junior high school at the beginning of the 60s and then enters college in 1967, and it's just to see through the eyes of a one kid how that moment felt, and then I created this sort of political thriller story, and then at a certain point decided, oh no, the way to tell this story is not just with the "you are there," you know, here's a kid talking to you in the first person in the 60s, but she will be writing this book as her memoir as a 63, 64, 65 year old woman in the present day, and she will go back and forth between trying to reconstruct her youth and that time, and trying to figure out what happened and why, because this scheme she got involved with in her anti-war zealousness sort of went off the rails, but she, despite that, has been able to live this very successful life, including working for the government in a very senior position, and has never known the full story of what happened and why she was able, and she and her friends were able to walk away from this without any consequences, so that's what the story is. And then, you know, once I wrote it, all other kinds of, I didn't begin with a theme, but then I realized, oh, talking about this generation in terms of not paying consequences and that's interesting. I didn't realize that's what I was writing about, but I kind of am. And people pretending to be something they're not and keeping secrets is an interesting thing to me, and I think resonant in any age. And so that's where that came from. And so it was both an attempt to write a thriller, and there's this woman, which is a girl, she and her friends are growing up in suburban Chicago and become obsessed with James Bond books, which were current and being published at the time, and began sort of modeling their little 12, 13, 14 year old lives on the characters in the Bond books. And so it also became a story about how people can sort of turn themselves into fictional characters, and the dangers of that, as well as the pleasures of that.
You may remember that one of the great boosts to the Bonds book was John F. Kennedy saying he was one of his favorite authors.
Absolutely. In 1961, he said that in Life magazine. Exactly. And which is so interesting. I mean, and as I'm talking about my characters sort of blurring fiction and reality, here was, you know, this James Bondish president of the United States saying, no, my favorite book is To Russia with Love, you know.
And you mentioned that some people can walk away from these things, and some can't. Bill Ayers can't do anything without it being pointed out, his so-called terrorist days, you know. And anyone that knows
that's
him,
true,
including the president, is
that's true. Although Bill Ayers and his wife Bernadine Dorn, despite the fact that they were, you know, planted bombs for many years as weather people outlaws, have also, even though their past is, if not an open book, fully public, and they serve time, they leave pretty productive and not uncomfortable lives. So, you know, I think so many people of my generation, your generation, and other generations too, so often talk, but especially people who were young in the 60s and 70s, say, my God, what I got away with when I was that time when we did this, the time when we did that. Oh, my gosh. If my kids did that, I'd kill them. What we got away with. So I think that became a kind of generational theme of what we got away with. And that was one of the things I was exploring in True Believers.
I don't believe that Ayers ever did time for anything, but Bernadette Dorn did. And the only people then who were really willing to do time were the Dan Berrigans and the peace protesters who said, okay, take me away. And they did.
That's right. And again, the Dan Berrigan and people were, you know, didn't blow anything up. They tried to destroy draft records. But their protests were in the long tradition of, you know, essentially symbolic protests and civil disobedience of the Henry David Thoreau kind. And they did not. They did not see themselves as, you know, guerrillas actually engaged in a revolution as Bernadine Dorn and her compatriots did.
The same year that you published True Believers, you also became involved with another public radio show, Kings County. Tell us about that show.
Yeah, Kings County was a WNYC, again, which is the home station out of which we do Studio 360. I had this idea and that we should do as a sort of summer show, the way that, I don't know if you remember when we were young, so there would be special variety shows on in the summer on television, and they would just be on for this television. They were great fun, and I thought, wow, we could do that. Why don't we do a show this summer, and maybe we'll keep doing it, and other summers. But that would be a live variety show with magicians and musicians and comedians and storytellers and all kinds of things. I mean, somebody said, oh, so what you're trying to do is Urban Home Companion. I said, well, you know, you can call it that, maybe. So it was a live show that we did on in big theaters and various in Brooklyn, and did three of those, because we had done and continue to do live Studio 360 shows, which we now that I've done Kings County and I've sort of again learned the dynamics and of doing a live show with a live audience and which is different than what we do on the radio every week. We now do more of those kinds of live shows for Studio 360. So we've sort of absorbed the some of the things we learned during Kings County and now have that be a part of Studio 360 as well.
The two summer variety fill-in shows I remember the most, there was one with George Carlin, Buddy Rich, and Buddy Greco that I thought was terrific.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And then it was also one that Jack Burns and Avery Shriver had together. And
that was
also great.
Exactly.
Back to Studio 360, you've had an incredible group of guests, and people can find them on your comprehensive website, www.kurtanderson.com, in the Studio 360 section. You've had from Madeleine Albright to Neil Young doing it alphabetically. Tell us about some of the ones that stick the most in your mind.
Well, I mean, the one that I was most, I guess, excited about and terrified by was in 2003. I'd been doing the show at that point for 3 years, so I sort of felt like, okay, I know what I'm doing now. But it was just before the war in Iraq was going to begin. But it was clear for some time that the war in Iraq was going to begin. And at that time, we did most of our shows were themed shows. We said, let's do a show about war and how war is depicted in literature and in film and the nature of American wars, and just war will be our theme. Who should we get? I said, well, let's try to get Susan Sontag. Susan Sontag has written interestingly about war. She went from being a, you know, standard peace party person to then when the war in the former Yugoslavia happened, called for U.S. intervention to help the Bosnians and so forth. So I thought she'd be great and talk about idols and heroines of mine. I had read her essays as a high school student and then as a college student, thought, you know, as her reputation was, she's about one of the smartest people on earth. She agreed to come on, and that was thrilling. And then I did incredible, lots, probably more. You say you do 10 or 15 times for every hour of research work you do. I did so much more preparatory research for that show than I've ever done before since. And then a couple of days before she was to come on, her assistant was sort of making final logistical arrangements with one of my producers, and she said to him, you know, I just want you to know, Ms. Sontag does not suffer fools, which he told me, and I thought, oh, great, this is going to be great. But she came on. We had a great conversation. We disagreed about certain things, but we disagreed civilly and disagreed in a way that got us to where we both were kind of discovering new avenues of understanding in real time. It was great. It was fantastic. I had a great time with her. She seemed to have a good time. And then I got from her the first and really one of the very only handwritten thank you notes from a guest that I've ever gotten, and saying how much she'd enjoyed it, which of course went into my collection of beloved relics immediately. And of course she passed away not that long after. And so I'm just really, she is, all things considered, I guess, I mean, you know, as you say, I've had, you know, amazing musicians, filmmakers, writers, all kinds of people on, many of whom were heroes, but the Susan Sontag one was the one that so far I you know, in both in terms of when it came, what it was about, who she was an extraordinary moment.
I'll ask you about some of them. Was Mel Brooks the tough interview?
Oh, so not tough. So delightful. And that was just like a year or two ago. Mel Brooks was just, as one might imagine, I mean, you know, you turn him on and, you know, you don't have to do much. You just sort of get out of his way and let him be funny. No, he was a great interview and so alive and so, you know, one of those people who one comes across every so often. I remember thinking when I saw him, wow, if that's 90 or whatever he was at the time, I'm willing to go to 90. If I can be that sharp and funny and intelligent and all the rest. He was a delight.
I didn't hear your Paul Rubens interview. Did you touch on the indecent exposure and Kitty porn arrest? And if so, how did he handle the questions?
I did not touch on the Kitty porn and indecent exposure. I figured, you know, everybody knows that, and he addressed it, and I decided not to go there. He at that time he was doing a Broadway stage version of Pee Wee's Playhouse, so I was really focused on not even his personal life at all, but rather the fact that I had as an adult, as a parent of children in the late 80s, had loved Pee Wee's Playhouse, been amazed by it, and really talked about that and about the show. So, no, I you know, I don't know. Maybe I am not. I mean, which isn't to say that I haven't asked uncomfortable and even confrontational things of people sometimes, I just decided in that case not to do so.
You've also had a great collection of authors on the show: Nicholson Baker, Roy Blunt, Ray Bradbury, Michael Chabon, Robert Coles, on and on, Nick Hornsby, Carl Harrison, John Updike, Walter Mosley, and Gore Vidal, and many more. Are there any particular incidents from any of those interviews that warrant the retelling?
Well, the Gore Vidal one was, again, he was a guy I've admired and who's life and work I'd been, you know, interested in and admiring of for years. When we were doing Spy magazine in 1989, we'd had a cover story about feuds of various kinds and talked, among other things, about the feud between William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal. And in fact, we had in this cover package a whole page sidebar about Gore Vidal's litigiousness, because he had sent many letters, been involved in libel litigation and so forth. And said that he was litigious. He had threatened to sue us over saying he was litigious at the time. It was one of the, and nobody ever sued, actually filed a libel suit against, or defamation or anything else against Spy when I was there. But this is one of the ones that came close, which was, of course, ironic since, you know, he was saying, I'm going to sue you for saying I sue people. So he comes on the show a few years ago, and I said, Mr. Vidal, you may not remember. And before I could even finish the sentence, he said, you mean when you said that I was litigious in 1989 in Spy magazine, young man? And I said, yes, that's what I mean. And so we had a fun and good-humored conversation about that. So that was fantastic. He also, even though, again, it was very late in his life, he was still, I got a real sense of why he was, beyond being a skillful writer, what a great storyteller and raconteur he was. He told a great story about being with Tennessee Williams and the President of the United States, who may not have yet been the President of the United States, that is to say John F. Kennedy, in Palm Beach, and doing a great impersonation of Tennessee Williams Gore Vidal is telling Tennessee Williams not to be looking so lasciviously at the president's back end as he was. And it was a great encounter. And again, to have somebody who had threatened to take me to court 20 years earlier to come on and even though we still disagreed about whether or not we had the facts right or not, it was a delightful sort of coming full circle event.
A book that no one talks about by him, that's one of the funniest books I ever read, is Live from Golgotha, where he has...
Uh-huh.
Did you read that? Do you know the story?
I did not.
He had Timothy, who was Paul's supernumerary, Timothy and someone else that were going to be hosting an NBC show about Golgotha, and it was hilarious.
He was a pretty fearless character.
Ray Bradbury is interesting because talk about coming full circle. He was part of an anthology that I was involved in way ahead of his time, back in 1983, called Digital Deli. And it was a whole bunch of people that were writing about technology or people that use technology. So we had Bradbury, and we had Steve Levy, who's recently with Wired. We had Esther Dyson, that you and I mentioned earlier off the air. By the way, she's been on the show, and she's a terrific interview.
Yep.
You might look at her. And we had Henny Youngman, and we had William F. Buckley. And Bradbury was interested. He did an essay. And years later, my son was on a panel at San Diego Comic-Con, and Bradbury was the keynote speaker about a year before he died. So it came full circle.
Yeah, no, and Ray Bradbury was, you know, one of the living authors whom I read very young, who really excited me about the power of fiction and storytelling. So it was fantastic to meet him. We had him on the air a couple times, actually.
I see that you've interviewed Jaron Lanier. I'm currently reading his Who Owns the Future, and I've read his other books. Did his view of the state of technology and his real concern for the future cause you to rethink your own views in any way?
I think given that he's not just a commentator or an observer or a writer, but a guy who has been, you know, a pioneer in this world, he comes with some real standing to talk about it. And as you know, he makes, his critiques are extraordinary and radical. They are, you know, suggesting, for instance, that in the Facebooks and Googles of the world, because they're essentially, they've made their multi-billion dollar businesses on all of our backs and fingers, by that we are creating content for free for them, and therefore we should each get tiny payments for the work we're doing on their behalf. It's really interesting, and although he, for instance, doesn't say, I understand why this is complicated and difficult, but I'm just throwing this out there so people understand that there is a massive con game aspect to the digital business world as we are living it today. Yeah, I thought it was. I mean, I think he's a fascinating character, an absolutely fascinating character. Earlier this year, actually, in Miami at a conference, I moderated a panel discussion about essentially the internet between him and this very smart writer named Clive Thompson, who writes about technology, and the novelist Michael Chabon, and that the sparks flew, especially between Clive Thompson and Jaron. Jaron quite understandably believes that he knows a lot more than pretty much anyone else about the nature of the digital world, and so in addition to disagreement, unless you have his standing as an early pioneer of virtual reality and digital gadgets and software of various kinds, you're in that debate or in that argument at a disadvantage. But it was fantastic, and I think I'm really glad he exists as a person in the discourse.
It's funny you mentioned that. In either 1990 or 1991, I was one of the people that co-founded something called the Computer Freedom and Privacy Conference. It's now in its 29th year, and we brought together civil libertarians, hackers, business people, and law enforcement, and Esther Dyson, who we just mentioned before, she raised the point that people, they were selling her information, and she wanted to be paid for it, and of course that never happened,
yes, exactly, and probably won't, but I really do think there are big issues, and some, not all of which Jaron has dealt with in his books yet, but I think we haven't even begun to figure out as a society and as a political economy how we are going to deal with, the future of robots and AI and what that means for jobs in the economy. And how the bounty of society is going to be distributed as this evolution goes forward. I mean, you know, it is not the only explanation of the inequality that's grown in this country the last 30 years, but it's part of it. And the kind of 19th and 20th century ideas of, oh, we'll have social welfare, oh, we'll have this, that may not operate effectively as the 21st century proceeds, and as there simply perhaps isn't enough work of dignity for people I mean, we look at previous industrial revolutions and people say, oh, it always worked its way out, itself out. Yeah, we got rid of agriculture, but then there were all these other new industries. And that's true, and maybe it'll happen again, but I'm not entirely convinced that it will. And as I say, I don't think we've even begun to consider and discuss how wealth, profit, goods, all of it, are to be distributed in a world where, you know, we don't need 120 million people in the U.S. labor force because half of them are robots. John, we could talk all night, but I'm afraid I need to sign off for this evening.
Okay, I was going to ask you, is there anything else you want the audience to know?
Other than listen to Studio 360, either as a podcast or on your local radio station, assuming I finish the book I'm working on, look out for my next book late in 2015 or early in 2016.
All right, well, it's been a pleasure, Kurt. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Then we'll be in touch. And in the words of the Met radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets wouldn't put it in a book, go to my website, www.johnmack13, for URLs for previous shows, and tune in next week. Until then, as they say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, steady, Silver, steady.
That was great.